Welcome to the OrthoClips podcast series, where we're going to discuss the latest hot topics and high-impact papers in orthopedic surgery. I'm your host, Saqib Rahman. Let's get this episode started. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Dustin Greenhill. He's an associate program director of the orthopedic surgery residency at the St. Luke's University Health Network in Bethlehem, PA. He's assistant clinical professor at the Temple University School of Medicine and a pediatric orthopedic and scoliosis surgeon. We're going to be discussing management of length unstable pediatric femur fractures, best practice. Dustin, it's great to have you on the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Great topic. And Dr. Greenhill was first author on a paper in the JAAOS that he could tell you a little bit about, as well as related paper on the treatment of length unstable pediatric femur fractures, children aged 5 to 11. That's a review paper in the May 1st, 2024 JAAOS. I'll reference it again at the end. So Dr. Greenhill, why don't you maybe start off telling us, you know, what's been your perspective of the evolution of management of these injuries? You know, why is it an important topic that we should be familiar with? And, you know, if you can, maybe tell us a little bit about a personal and maybe a patient encounter or something that was very meaningful for you in when it comes to management of these.
Sure. Yeah, I have always thought that the topic of femoral shaft fractures, as simple as it seems, and pediatric orthopedic surgery specifically, has really encompassed a lot of concepts that are central to pediatric orthopedics. And it's also, the treatment has undergone a lot of evolution over the last several decades. So decades ago, we would hip spica cast a lot more of these, especially in older children, and expect good healing and substantial remodeling in the femoral shaft. And while that is true, improved surgical techniques and honestly improved social, you know, certain social factors have led to increased expectations for fixation in older children. So if you look, I was writing, you know, the AOS ROC, and we wrote an original paper, which is the reason that this paper was written afterwards in JOS a couple of years ago, where the evolution of treatment of femoral shaft fractures changed quickly. And there was a lot of research in our field done to figure out who the best patient was for one of several different fixation options. And so that has been the evolution in these injuries, that now we have several options within our arsenal, and we would like to identify the perfect patient for each one of them. For me, a personal story, this was no more relevant than when I was years ago, I was in board collection, and I had a patient who was on the younger side, 8 years old, but on the heavier side. And, you know, we worked in Philadelphia, and she lived on the third floor and didn't really have any help to get her up there when she left the hospital. And so ideally, you might flex nail that patient, but she was a little too heavy for it. She had a barely comminuted fracture. So some of the data said I should not flex nail that. I should submuscular plate. But if I did that, you can't weight bear. And so what would she do when she went home? And so I think any of the multiple main options in this paper would have been sufficient for her. And especially in the face of board collection, trying to follow the evidence, I just wanted to add clarity to the evidence about this controversial topic for surgeons that are treating these injuries, especially if you're covering pediatric orthopedic injuries at a non-pediatric place.
Yeah, I think these can certainly create some anxiety for the doctors taking care of them unless they are really comfortable or managing these frequently. And, you know, there are surgeons who treat these occasionally and need to know what are the best methods, you know, in 2024. So what are the factors that go into decision-making for management of these injuries? If you can tell us maybe some key points, takeaway points that, you know, either from your article or you want to just emphasize here.
Yeah, so the typical key factors classically cited are age and weight. I tip when I teach this to residents and etc., I break them up into my own mind. I break them up into patient-specific and surgeon-specific factors. So the patient-specific factors will be age, weight, fracture pattern, the bone quality, the size of the intramedullary canal. Can you fit intramedullary fixation in there, and what kind are you going to use? And then the social factors that I kind of alluded to previously. How fast is the patient going to need to walk? Are they going to be able to come for follow-up appointments? Is a second surgery possible for them or not? And then surgeon-specific factors are definitely experience, comfort with the technique. Some surgeons are more comfortable trying to flex nail, say, a more proximal femoral shaft fracture or a more comminuted femoral shaft fracture than others, or using titanium versus stainless steel. And that submuscular plates too. There are some centers that submuscular plate more than others, and so surgeons may be more familiar with that technique versus others. So there's those are basically the main factors that you think about.
Okay. Let's talk about techniques. What are some of the techniques, very briefly, that surgeons today should be familiar with if they're going to be managing these injuries? And then maybe, with each technique, a few important tips or suggestions for success.
Yeah, so above the age of five, the reason this paper cut off at five is because treatment in preschool age children can be somewhat surgeon and patient dependent, whether you hip spike of them or use internal fixation. But above 5 years old, and the AOS recent guidelines reflect this, that we're typically thinking about fixation and the three methods of definitive fixation that we talk about in the paper: flexible intramedullary nails, submuscular plating, and a lateral entry rigid intramedullary nail. Those are the three techniques that surgeons should be familiar with if they're going to be treating a femoral shaft fracture in a child. In general, length stable patterns in kids this age can be treated with a flexible intramedullary nail. If they're too old, if they're on the older side, older than 10 or 11, which was outside of the scope of this paper. If it's too comminuted, if the fracture's considered length unstable by some definitions, but just not very comminuted, and that's why we talk about the Winquist classification in our paper, then they may still be a candidate for flexible intramedullary nails. But if it's too comminuted, maybe not. And if they're too heavy, and typically you're going to be talking about a patient over 50 kilograms, they are not a great candidate for flexible intramedullary nails. So you're trying a flexible intramedullary nail most children that are younger and lighter. If they're older and heavier, a lateral entry rigid intramedullary nail is a good option. But there's a lot of controversy about what the youngest age can be. And so typically surgeons will say 8 or 9, and we can talk about the proximal femoral morphologic changes that happen if you violate the greater trochanteric hypothesis. We can talk about that later, but anything that doesn't fit these two typically gets a submuscular plate. So a younger patient or a patient with a small intramedullary canal that can't get a lateral intramedullary nail and has a more length unstable fracture, that's a perfect candidate for a submuscular plate.
Any other tips regarding when you say, the lateral entry nails for those who aren't that familiar with it? Can you tell us what the entry point is? What are some things to be aware of when you're coming in at such an extreme angle proximally?
Yeah, that's definitely an important factor. So doing a lateral intramedullary nail is not the same case sometimes as doing a greater trochanteric starting point, tip of the greater troch, or piriformis fossa starting point. You have to come in pretty lateral. The nail is made to bend lateral proximally. My tips are to aim with your starting point, your threaded guide wire that you put in to ream over, aim below the lesser troch. To make sure that you don't have trouble. Kids will have very strong bone in the proximal femoral metaphysis, and it's hard to get the, even with the bent tip, it's hard to get the ball tip guide wire into the intramedullary canal where you need to be if you're not aiming distal enough after a starting point that's usually more lateral than you're used to. So that's the number one tip. And then another thing is look at the technique guides, because some of the lateral entry nails are made to start, at the upper third of the greater trochanteric hypothesis, and some of them are made to start right in the middle of it.
Okay, good. And I think people can look up that technique to sort of visualize what you're describing. And what about submuscular plating? Can you tell me what kind of plate are you using? What size plate exactly? What are I mean, I'm sure it's going to be different lengths, but which trays, what kind of plate are you using? What are some of the techniques that you're doing that help to make this work out well for your patients? Where are you bending the plate? How do you template for this kind of thing?
Yeah, so the most important part or the most important technical portion of using a submuscular plate is just respecting the fracture site and truly being submuscular but not subperiosteal. It's an internal external fixator like we talk about. The plate options are variable based off of where you are on the femoral shaft. So if you're more distal, then sometimes you can use a fracture that's made to respect the physis, but live on the distal femur. If you're more proximal, you can flip that plate around. So some of the companies will make a physeal sparing distal femur plate that has a little bit of femoral bow built in. And if you're right, they've described 3.5 versus 4.5. I personally, in a smaller child, they'll use a 3.5. For example, like a 3.5 narrow. Plate with the femoral bow contoured in. In a larger patient, you consider a 4.5 narrow, and I don't usually use the broad one. But those are all options. I think those are the things you need. Other tips when you do that technique are you're going to want to try to get an indirect reduction. One of the tips is you can still use KORs or Steinmann pins percutaneously to hold the fracture in place to make it a little more manageable while you slide your submuscular plate in and put the screws in the top and bottom. And then you can take those out later. Another tip that somebody actually said to me when I was learning the technique is get ready to accept a reduction that you might not like looking at. So we're typically, when we plate fractures in orthopedics that are not comminuted, we're going for direct healing or primary bone healing. And so we want the fracture to look perfectly reduced, but this is a bridging plate in a child that has tremendous healing capability and remodeling potential. So it is okay to have appropriate alignment, but not perfect x-rays with perfect plate placement.
When you have seen failures with submuscular plating, complications related to the fixation technique, is there a common thread that you see?
So the real answer to that is no, because the technique is such a successful technique and the rate of complications is so low that it's hard to identify issues with the technique. It is, I think, if I've ever seen a submuscular plate go on and there were issues with it, it was that, maybe there wasn't, they didn't span the fracture site enough if somebody wanted to, but these are kind of very specific scenarios. I think the technique is pretty straightforward. I think it's really user-friendly. It's surgeon-friendly because most people should be familiar with the ability to do this. And to be honest, that any issues I've seen with people doing a submuscular plate is not actually doing a submuscular plate, opening the fracture and putting a lag screw across it even or something like that. That's not a typical treatment for a pediatric femoral shaft fracture.
Okay. Tell me a little more about evidence, in terms of, what the literature tells us about the evidence for these, techniques for these length unstable fractures. You gave several methods. You gave reasons why you would use these methods, and I'm sure that's, worked well for you. And what does the literature say?
So the AOS clinical practice guidelines recently and in the last couple of years updated their levels of evidence to say that there was ample evidence to support flexible intramedullary nailing in children 5 to 11. And one of the main papers, in my opinion, and one of the main drivers of this was Ernie Sink. He was at Colorado at the time. Now he's at HSS. And he, in 2005, identified this issue with flex nails were taking over in America, and they were becoming very popular in femoral treatment of femoral shaft fractures. And he said, basically, in his 2005 paper, that flexible intramedullary nails are good, a good treatment for femoral shaft fractures in children, but just not in all of my patients for some reason. And so he tried to figure out which patients didn't do great. And his conclusion was that what he called length unstable fractures, which is the topic of this paper, were the ones that tended to have a higher risk of failing treatment in flexible intramedullary nailing. He did not look at age or weight. And so two main authors, Moroz and also Christine Ho, who I worked with in Dallas, wrote really good papers where they basically identified that age over 10 or 11 years old and then weight above 50 kilograms were additional red flags for looking at failure of flex nails, and failure typically being either a malunion, so it's just too unstable, or the patient's too heavy or too old for the fracture to maintain appropriate alignment before it heals. And then another big complication rate cited by all these papers was prominent flex nails. So improvements in art, familiarity with the technique and art technique to avoid the known most common complication of prominent nails. So that's 2005. That's Ernie Sink's paper. And then Christine Ho and Moroz, they drove the red flags of flex nails forward. And Ernie Sink followed it up with a paper in 2010, where he said, "I changed my practice. I now submuscular plate length unstable femur fractures, and my rate of complications with these fractures has dramatically decreased." And that is the evidence that supports submuscular plates. And subsequent follow-ups and reports, basically case series of submuscular plates report that they have such rare complications, if any, that it just supports it as being a good technique. The lateral entry rigid intramedullary nails are still somewhat new, and so that's why we don't know the lower age limit. A lot of the support for lateral entry rigid intramedullary nails will come from our familiarity in the adult world with IM nails and femurs, and Brumback's evidence that you can weight bear in femurs and that they heal well. So that's why we, as pediatric orthopedists, want to treat people with a rigid intramedullary nail if we can. And the reason why the lateral entry nail exists is because James Beatty published an important case series where he highlighted that if AVN is a risk, then why would you risk that at all? So let's create a nail that avoids the blood supply, the transphyseal blood supply in the proximal femur.
And in the paper for the listeners, there's definitely some commentary towards the evidence. There's a nice figure at the end of the paper also showing kind of an evidence-based algorithm for how to think about management of different fractures at different levels, mid-shaft, proximal, distal third, and then obviously, like you mentioned, Winquist classification to consider the comminution, going back to the first thing you told us about, factors going into decision making. So you can take a look at that as well.
Yeah, and that figure, I'll tell you, Sak, that was hard to create. And one of the things I left out about evidence-based treatment in these is based on the type of flex nails you use, if you want a flex nail fracture. So there's evidence that stainless steel is stronger, more biomechanically stable than titanium. If you really look in the details and the papers of flex nailing, the patients that tend to do better are the surgeons that are saying that there are certain length unstable fractures you can flex nail. They tend to have higher rates of stainless steel nails. And then when you look at the fractures being flex nailed that are reported to be length unstable, they're not the most unstable fracture that you can imagine. They're a low Winquist grade, so one or two. They're barely comminuted fractures. In very light and very young patients. And so that's where the evidence-based treatment of these comes in, because the recent trend in the literature is to try to say there are certain length unstable fractures that you can flex nail. And the literature is so heterogeneous, and the fact that Ernie Sink's paper says You can't flex nail, or you shouldn't flex nail length unstable. Christine Ho's paper says that you shouldn't flex nail older or heavier kids. That we're trying to put it all together at this point.
Thanks for that background explaining that. Well, before we wrap up, can you comment a little bit on future directions that you think the community should be perhaps doing to better understand how to manage these?
Yes, I think that definitely this paper helps figure out what you are allowed to flex nail. And if you can't flex nail, that submuscular plate is an excellent alternative or primary option. I think the future direction, no doubt, lies in figuring out who we are allowed to lateral entry rigid endophthalmic nail, meaning what the lower age limit is. A lot of there's papers talking about lateral entry rigid intramedullary nailing. Kids that are 8 years old. There are case series where the youngest patient was seven something years old. The morphologic changes in the proximal femur are unclear. A lot of the literature comes from Perthes literature when we do a greater trochanteric apophysodesis. We know that it's less effective, but not ineffective when we do it at 8 or 9 or later. And any of the patients in these case series that were very young that got a lateral entry nail, they did have more morphologic changes in the proximal femur. And in the era of FAI and lateral lung coverage, we really don't know how an 8-year-old with a lateral intramedullary nail with subsequent Coxa valga is going to do 30 years from now. And so last week, we had our combined European and North American EPOSNA meeting, and somebody presented essentially ABOS data where more and more people are using lateral entry nails. But again, I'd remind people it's without an understanding of what exactly the lower age limit is. That's the next step for us.
Interesting. So more to come. Maybe we'll see a part three of your paper in the future. What I'm referring to is the recent article in the JAAOS, May 1st, 2024, treatment of length unstable pediatric femur fractures in children age 5 to 11. This is by Dr. Dustin Greenhill, who I've been talking to, and I think we covered a lot. Dustin, really appreciate you coming on the call. I asked the listeners to check out the article as well as the previous article. And I really appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.